This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 28th of April, 1959. The title of this lecture is Theory of Processes. This tape is 55 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Thank you. All right. Today, we're going to take up the subject of processes, which in English is processes. I finally gave it up, you know. I used to come over here and I would pronounce all the key words. I never could quite go theta, but I used to pronounce all the words in English, you see, and then I go back over and I try to pronounce them in American, and halfway through a Congress or something like that, I'd find myself talking about processing in America and over here processing. So I just figured out, well, we'll do it all in Martian and call it processing. The main thing that you should know about processes is that they won't do anything for anybody, any place. That's the first thing you should know about them. You can write one down in a book, and you can put the book on the auditor's chair, and you can go away, and you can come back hours later, and nothing has happened. But do you know that this one point is the most overlooked point in all auditing? People talk about the process doing something for somebody. Now, I will admit that the processes of Scientology are clever. I will admit that they are sheer genius. I thought them up myself. Basically, research-wise, technologically, and for other reasons, they do represent, in vignettes you might say, the totality of information about the mind. And it is quite wonderful that a process can be run on an HAS co-audit course, very like wound up doll, and can get very interesting and good results. You see, this is tremendous. And today, even more than any other time in the history of Dianetics and Scientology, we have to say bluntly and squarely that the process doesn't do anything. So we have to say that even more so, because today it looks even more that it does something. Now, what does do something? All the process is the postulate on which a series of errors have accumulated, which postulate has become an effect point in the PC rather than a cause point. And all the process does is reverse effect point to cause point. As the PC himself does the process each time, he more and more closely approaches cause point. But, of course, what is wrong with him is that this particular postulate, even though he made it and agreed to it originally, see, he's the source of all the trouble, has become an effect point, and he is just totally overwhelmed by this postulate. The postulate is no longer at cause in the PC, but in the PC is total effect. Now, let's look at this in terms of determinisms. The postulate is no longer self-determined in the PC, but is other-determined in the PC. Got the idea? Now, all you have to do then is reverse effect to cause, or, which is the same way of saying it, other determinism to self-determinism. And that is what a process is. It, however, is simply a thought. It is inactive. It is inert. I know it was very clever and it's very witty, and we wouldn't get any place if we didn't have the exact postulates which have become aberrated in man. You see, if we didn't have those, we wouldn't get any place. That's true. But it is, after all, an inert postulate. It was the action concerning the postulate that got the individual in trouble. The complications which built up on this postulate were the things that got the people into the shape they're in. You get the idea. The postulate is then neither a doingness nor a villain. See, a lot of people say, oh boy, that's villainy, and they start blaming it and blaming it and blaming it, and if I just never thought something like this, if I'd never agreed to it, why, I'd just be in beautiful, I don't know. He probably would have found something else. Undoubtedly would have found some other idea to get mucked up with. You see? Because in the normal course of cause and effect, in the normal course of trying to stay self-determined amongst a million other determinisms, the individual, no matter what he tried to do anywhere, would eventually have gotten pretty lost. It was pretty inevitable that he got lost. It isn't, we can say it was his fault or it's other people's fault, so on. It's nobody's fault. It's a universe. Now, when a universe is constructed, you get a tremendous number of first dynamics, but you get a much larger number from any viewed first dynamic of other dynamics, right? See, to the individual, it appears, you see, that he only has one viewpoint, and he is surrounded by an almost infinite number of other determinisms. You get the idea? Well, one of the basic sources of aberration is the basic aberration of quantitative versus qualitative. Actually, a thetan has no business dealing with quantity. Quantitative ideas are all very poor, and you'll find most of them are at the heart of aberration. The individual feels poor because he has 1 pound, and he knows somebody else is rich because the other person has 1,000,000 pounds. Well, we can see through this. The fellow with 1 pound might be well, the fellow with 1,000,000 pounds might be sick. You see, he's not necessarily richer or poorer just because there is a quantity involved. I've known a fellow who had millions of dollars, who was the poorest man I ever met. He couldn't have anything. He actually couldn't bring himself to buy anything, and furthermore, his affairs were always so involved that he couldn't have any money, and I was always buying him breakfast or supper or something of the sort. Now, it's quantity, and the first error of quantity is one, not 1,000,000. We go toward one as being the basic error of quantity. Now, this is a difficulty, because this universe is a two universe. This universe has its basic digits, you might say, two. There aren't any ones in this universe to amount to anything. There's two. I think it was old Dymaxian geometry that Buckminster Fuller, who first demonstrated this with enormous skill, he really overwhelmed me. I was quite interested. He showed conclusively that no mass structure of the universe could exist as a single digit. We hear of flying saucers. Flying saucers are supposed to show up and disappear and so forth. Personally, I think it's the Panamanian government or something like that trying to frighten everybody. But anyway, because I know personally, to my personal knowledge, the last 5 saucers that I had in my command were surveyed. Anyway, these saucers actually run by attempting single unit in a double unit universe. All you have to do is separate the inside of the saucer from the universe, and it will do all sorts of weird things. And I won't bother to go into that any further, but somebody who has a penchant for theory of equations and so forth can work it out rather easily. All you have to do is isolate something and then make it try to gain somewhere or something else, and you have propulsion. It's very simple. It's so simple that they won't discover it for another few hundred years here on Earth, probably. Anyway, well, not unless they can use it in war. They discovered it once, they could use it in war. The thing I'm getting at is simply this. The universe, we have agreed, is evidently impossible to inhabit as a single unit. That's just it. I mean, it's everything in this universe is two or more. Two or some multiple. Let's take chemistry. And we get electrons and protons. And every time we get something that tries to stand totally alone, utterly and completely alone, we usually get a collapse. There is nothing in this universe that is standing utterly and totally alone. No power of any kind is ever generated by a single terminal. Now, you see, power in this universe is derived from the laws of this universe, which, of course, are postulates, which we've helped to make or agreed upon and so on. And these postulates decree at once that no power shall exist in the presence of a single terminal. And if you take an electric motor and remove the second terminal in it, you're not going to get a running motor, that's all. That's it. Power is usually derived from trying to keep two terminals separated and being able to fix them in space. Two terminals that think they ought to be together are separated, and the randomity which occurs between them trying to stay apart and get together. That's about the way a motor runs. That's power. We're not too interested in power or electrical flows. We're much more interested in postulates. But an electrical particle or a mass is, of course, a postulate. A lot of Scientologists don't ever totally connect this one. I've seen them do it. They say, ah, yes, well, I'll think terminal, and then a terminal will appear. Oh, boy, that's the old magic universe. That was how they got everybody fouled up in the magic parts of the track. You'll run a PC into one of these one time where everybody is being fooled by everybody. And the way you make a postulate which results in a terminal is simply to make a terminal. You get the idea. There's no via of, I now will think that I will mock up a postulate and one ought to appear from someplace. I'm sorry, but there's nothing going to happen unless you put the terminal there. There is no great god called Throgmagog that walks up with a terminal and places it out there simply because you have decided that one should be there. These people have decision mixed up with postulate. All right, you can decide a terminal should be there, but you're going to wait till the end of time for one to appear unless you or somebody you're in communication with puts it there. It's got to be placed there. The whole idea of deity is making a postulate and then waiting for somebody to make it happen. Do you follow this easily? Huh? A fellow says, well, a great giant will now appear in the room. You know, he says this, great giant will now appear in the room, and then he waits for somebody to cart this big giant up and put it in the room, you see? Well, there's no big giant going to occur in the room unless he puts the big giant in the room. That's it. So postulates get down to the lazy end of the scale. You see, and the individual says, well, a postulate is a thought. No. Time, space, energy, particles, anything that you want to think of, form, anything else, is a postulate. One conceives the isness of it to materialize it. In other words, he says it is there, it is there. He doesn't think a thought, you see, and then do something over here to make the thought come true. Got the idea? Postulates cover all the isness there is. Now, there was a very brilliant, highly influential woman called Mary Baker Eddy, lived in the 19th century. Mary Baker Eddy said, all is mind, all is infinite mind, and all is thought, And all sickness is the result of thinking wrong thoughts, and you've got to go on thinking right thoughts. This is a tremendous oversimplification of Christian Science, but I'll show you where this leads to. The idea was that thought was thought, and that was the end of it. Mass didn't exist. At least, this is the way the Christian Scientists learned it. Mass didn't exist. But it was just a sort of an illusion or a delusion that people thought was there, so it was there. Now, you get the little curve that's on this line? You see? This is the wonderfulest package of not-is you ever ran into. It's not for nothing that you find or found more Christian Scientists per religious denomination in insane asylums than any other religious denomination. Very interesting. They have a higher incidence of insanity in Christian Science. Now, we're not dead against Christian Science. I'm just showing you how you can go astray. I mean, we have nothing to do with Christian Science. You can just go madly astray this way. You can say, ah, I get it. A person thinks thoughts, you see. So these walls and floor and the sky and the space and the ceiling, that's all just an illusion. Somebody's been fooling us. That's pretty non sequitur when you stop thinking about this. If all this is an illusion, then they're saying it isn't. Illusion is a downgraded isness, isn't it? That's all an illusion is. All right, what's an illusion? When you get into walls, this whole subject of walls, you'll find out there's only one thing you know positively about walls. When you get into the subject of space, there's only one thing you know positively about space. And when you get into the subject of suns and moons and stars and meteors and all the rest of it, there's only one thing you know about them, absolutely and positively. When you get into the subject of form, there's only one thing you know absolutely, completely, and concretely. This is just terrific certainty. They are. That's for sure. You know that. And to the degree you cannot confront them, you say there's something else. But basically, they simply are. Whatever else you want to add to this, where they came from, where they're going to, what is their cycle of action, anything else is simply gilding up this one definite datum. They are. There's a mad difference between anything like Christian Science and Scientology. Christian Science says all is infinite mind and matter and so forth is an illusion. It really isn't. You see? Well, we get over into Scientology and start taking a look around, and we find something entirely new to the concept of philosophy. And, of course, this would have absolutely cracked the skull of Plato. Plato probably would have sat on his veranda or whatever he was using to contemplate the universe, if he ever did. Bright man. And if you'd given him this datum, you'd say, you see that tree? You see that tree, Plato? Well, now listen, Plato. Now hold on hard. Get a good grip on your toga. The first thing we know about that tree is that it is. You see that mountain over there, Plato? It is. Oh, man, you would have been there all night, all the next day. You would have probably been denounced as a great heretic. You'd have probably been denounced as something so wild, so fanciful, that not even the Stoics would have had anything to do with you. You probably would have been considered heretical. And much too theoretical for Greek philosophy. Yeah, I can see it now. If you'd taken poor Mary Baker Eddy, you said, now Mary, Mary, all this is very well. Do you see that wall over there, Mary? Now, you say it's infinite mind and God put it there, and you think, right, we're interested in that. Look at that wall, Mary. Now, that wall, we know one thing about it. That's for sure. We know one thing about it. It is. Remember what I told you about stable datum and confusion? Well, isness is the basic stable datum of any universe. And whenever a person has been balked and appalled and has been thrown away from this basic stable datum, he develops a tremendous amount of confusion. And this confusion he can state philosophically, or he can state it any other way he pleases, but it's all going to discharge if he looks at the wall and realizes the wall is. Now, he's liable, in processing, to get up to a much higher level. He not only realizes the wall is, but he realizes that it is dependent entirely for its source and existence upon his saying that it is. You see, and this gets to be the neatest, horribly difficult to confront postulate of the whole cockeyed works, because it not only is, but it is there with total responsibility. And when you can get somebody confronting is with total responsibility, philosophy walks out the window. So does religion. I'm afraid so does war and taxes. A person's domestic difficulties, the itch he contracted, almost anything you can think of, starts walking away the moment that he starts entering in upon this one proposition, that which is. Now, it's all very well to say, well, that which is. That's the statement with total irresponsibility. Now, reverse-wise, you wouldn't even use a word to describe the isness of a wall. And it's rather wonderful that in Scientology we can describe things which can't be described. And we do this all the time. You don't realize to what degree we do this. We describe the undescribable. That probably is the greatest development of Dianetics and Scientology, is the language of observation. It's been developed inside the subject. Now, people could never discuss these things philosophically before. They went off and developed tremendous, resounding polysyllables that had tremendous vias with great abstruse and obtuse meanings. And if you memorize this tremendous vocabulary of vias, you had it made. You notice most of Dianetics and Scientology is just in plain, run-of-the-mill words. Now, as we go along, these words develop more punch. They take on special connotations, but the specialness of the connotation is generally owing to the simplicity that we attach to it rather than the complexity. When we say communication, we do not mean, as they mean in engineering, a series of electronic formulas from integral calculus. You just say communication. Do you know the formula of communication? Walk in on some place like Ma Bell, big electronics laboratory. You walk in on what the engineers call Ma Bell. And you say, what is the formula of communication? And some fellow go off, the formula of communication? Well, it all depends on what you mean by communication. Talking probably about electronic brains. The formula is gone, it's SDYDX and so on. You go on over, and of course you got to get a slide rule out here in order to get this. Or he'd look at you bluntly and say, well, I must say that that is a very interesting question. He'd like to look at you and say, well, what the hell is it? Well, we have a good idea what communication is. We know what it is. Similarly, we can communicate what a wall is, or a mass, or a space. You see, it is a wall, or a mass, or space. Well, we can tell you where it came from. And people have been trying to find that out for a very, very long time. But to foist this off on you, and simply say, that is the way it is, if you don't answer up this way on an examination paper, you're dead, you're finished. That would be a very dirty trick, because that would just be to make you the effect of the most affected thing there is, which it simply isn't. See, think of the number of times somebody has come around to you and pounded it home, practically with a jackhammer, that this was the way it was, and this was the way it was going to be. What's this person doing? He's demonstrating an isness with an overwhelmingness, isn't he? So he's making you the effect of an isness. He's saying, this is the way conditions are. And if you don't take it this way, then you've had it. Well, fortunately, the one thing you cannot describe this way and have it turn into black magic is just what I've been talking to you about. But some cognition on your part is necessary, otherwise you tend to remain at the effect point of this statement about isness. Any postulate which has been called truth, that's sufficiently agreed upon to be known as truth, you see. Any postulate sufficiently agreed upon is truth. I told you the other day there are only a couple of basic truths. They're the first two axioms. They are true. They're close to an absolute as we can get. Anything else, as we've agreed upon it enough, well, we've got it. But you'll notice that a wall, as the result of a postulate, or that the wall is postulated by a person or being or you, is very fundamental as a truth. It is sufficiently fundamental as a truth that it can be uttered. Then because you are so much at the effect end of this thing, for a little while you don't come out in the clear about it. You could just accept it as a theoretical or intellectual concept. Say, I make that wall? I don't know. But look, I've at least got you making the wall. See, at least got you looking at the wall and guessing that maybe. See this? So we are coming up. So if we ever hit truth on the most agreed upon agreement, on the button, it tends to resolve it, and a person ceases to be the total effect of it, simply because total effect means that he can't even understand it. He's below it. If he understands it, he's at least getting up even with it somewhere. Processing puts you above it. Now, to walk out here and say to some man, is that wall? I'm going to tell you something for your own good. If you don't believe it, I'm going to beat hell out of you. Be polite about it. That wall is. It exists. And I want you to realize that it exists. And so forth, and keep shoving it in on him to this degree. I'm afraid you're not going to make a friend. No, because your attitude is devoid of much understanding, and there's certainly no ARC to carry it along, and he doesn't know what you're talking about. He doesn't have any channel approach to the subject at all. But what do you know? You can take somebody and run a process called 8C and get him to go around tapping walls, and he gradually, at what a gradient scale. It would be a gradient scale that a flea could make totally loaded. Because AC works on almost anybody. And he takes this gradient scale, and it's so gradual that as he walks over and hits that wall and walks through this space and hits that wall and walks over and hits another wall, and he just keeps going like this, it starts to dawn on him that it is. And you get all sorts of ideas discharging off this one idea that the wall is, and that's all you're processing him on, is the wall is. Now, because you make him touch it, you are putting him on a little bit of a via, true, because it's you that's making him touch it, but you're putting him into position of being cause toward it. Now, what is your gut? You've got him on a reach. See this? You got him on a reach to it. Now, all you're processing directly is exactly what I've been talking to you about. The process, the commands of 8C and so forth would not work at all if it weren't for just what I told you about, and if it weren't for the fact that you were making him touch the wall and that doingness had been added to the actual theory. Unless we add the presence of the auditor, unless we add the actuality of the action, our PC doesn't climb upstairs very rapidly. So we get one of the most effective processes there is, which is 8C. 8C has dragged an awful lot of people out of the doldrums. Dragged an awful lot of people up the line. It's a great process. It's one of the great processes. Now, when we tone 48C, we're going even further on the line, but it isn't always necessary to tone 48C. 8C is not tone 48C. You take somebody who is so lost that when he thinks of a wall, he says to him, well, that reminds me, any wall immediately re-stimulates a forgottenness of having stormed Acre and gotten a bunch of Greek fire in his puss. See, and wall, plum. What's he doing? He says, floor, see, So, space, space. This little square inch in front of my nose is absolutely intolerable. You say, well, how about the rest of the space in the room? And he'll vomit. I'm being quite blunt. That's what will happen with a cycle. The gradient scale of taking people into larger and larger spaces was an early one, but actually has been used in France. Dynamics has been taught in France for some time. It's also been in Germany for some time. There was something developed out of this, and they really got to going someplace. They also had another one that they took out of Dianetics, which is they dressed up people in the costume and surroundings of the life they were stuck in and let them work it out. Quite clever. But taking somebody outside. This is something for you to realize. This is part of an auditor's kit that I'm telling you right now. This individual's been lying in this small room, sick with the epiglottis, or whatever else he thought he had to have to get past these examinations or something. And he's very ill, and he's been lying in this small room, and he's been there for days and days and weeks and weeks and weeks. And you're going to process him. Well, it's all right for him to process him on the room, and it's all right for you to do an awful lot of things. But do you know, it would really be quite efficacious if you ran an old process called take a walk. Just got him into a little bit larger space. Now, the gradient scale of it is not really take a walk. It's to put him in a larger room. And the tremendous tiredness which he will experience is just giving him a little more space and a greater remoteness of wall. You take him out of his room into a larger room, he will start to experience tiredness. If you did that every day and gave him a little more space every day and gradient scaled him up the line a little bit more and a little bit more, well, the individual would snap out of it. It's quite interesting. It's something for you to know, because what you're doing is giving him a gradient scale of larger spaces to confront. And don't give it to him with such steep doses that he finds them unconfrontable, and you've got it made. Now, this is interesting. You let a puppy out of a box that he's been shipped in,
And just watch his reaction sometimes as he gets his anchor points back out. It's quite interesting. You should wonder why an animal who is caged up for a long time in one environment will stay around that environment afterwards. He will, you know. That is the basic premise of domestication. Works on husbands, wives, cats. Now, what is this? The individual has gotten out of the habit, you might say, or has become disconnected from the idea of muchness in terms of mass or space. It isn't a matter of conditioning, because we're not talking about an unknown thing now. It's a matter of familiarity. The individual has been so unfamiliar with larger spaces, so unfamiliar with larger masses, so unfamiliar with quantities, large quantities, that he's lost the knack of confronting them. See, he's dropped off. His familiarity is too poor now. So we suddenly give him a great big space. Or just take somebody whose favorite habitat is Times Square, 45th Street and 7th Avenue, something like that. Just take him and grab him by the scruff of the neck and drop him out in the middle of Arizona. And say to him suddenly, look at all that space! And he'd probably go mad. Works that way with masses. I remember taking somebody from the East Coast of the United States to the West Coast. And as you go, you run in first into some little lumps of soil on the eastern seaboard that they call mountains. And then you go a little bit further and you run into the Appalachians. And then you go a little long distance across the plains and you start running in the Rockies. You run into the Rockies. They're not terribly impressive, the Rockies, because you're already up so high when you're looking at them. But it's impressive enough to somebody that's used to molehills, you know. And then you run into the Cascades, and the Cascades leap up from sea level, and they are tremendous mountains. And it's a gradient scale. It's very interesting to take an Easterner and start rolling them west and showing them these larger and larger mountains, you know. And they just about got it made up that that's just about the biggest, doggondest set of mountains that they ever saw in their lives, you see. And they've got the ultimate. Now they've got the absolute ultimate. And then show them the Cascades, you see. And they say, oh, no, you see. There's some mountains out there that are standing 14,950 feet above sea level, you see. And they're all snow-covered, and they really rear off the plain. A lot of mass. Well, this is a problem in masses. Well, you start this same trip, and they get more and more engrossed in space. They don't believe this much space, and the unreality starts caving in on them. The country just isn't real, because you get out into the Middle West, and you just look and look and look, as on many other continents, and you see nothing but the curvature of the horizon. And you go to that horizon, and you see nothing but the distant horizon beyond you, you see. And you're just not likely to run out of space for a long time. Well, of course, with fast airplanes and that sort of thing, you can do this thing in Africa or Australia or even in Europe rather rapidly. But the space, in the absence of fast travel, gets terribly impressive, and people get feeling awfully unreal about all of this. The country just really doesn't exist. It just isn't quite there. It's not believable. You take drivers and tear them off across that much space, and they have accidents. They're used to driving around their little pueblo or something down in Mexico, and you take them on the highway between this their little pueblo and Mexico City, and that highway is long and flat and straight. And the straightest, best parts of it are the source of the most accidents. The best roads are the source of the most accidents, because they've got the most spaces in them. And the people can't tolerate those spaces. Now, these reactions to space, reactions to mass, reactions to time, all form a tremendous number of processes. And what are you doing? The process is nothing unless you are increasing the familiarity of the person with that thing you are processing toward, and putting the person, right along with it, more at cause over that thing than he has been. So a process does these two things. Increases his familiarity and puts him at cause. Process which doesn't do those two things is worthless, useless, and actually should be discouraged by you. Hypnotism is such a process. Hypnotism is a process that discourages familiarity, introverts, closes out, and fogs in. And of course, it has accompanying drop in reality, drop in communication, drop in anything. Somebody who has been taught hypnotism is liable to tell you that you can cure stammering easily with hypnotism. Well, I don't know. He'll tell you this, and maybe you can fix the fellow up so that he doesn't even know enough to stammer anymore. Just put him on a total machine. But this is quite remarkable. It's quite wonderful to see the drop, the real drop, over the next few days in the ability to live on the part of a person who has been hypnotized. It's very, very steep. It's very recognizable. Now, that's the reverse process. You're making him less familiar and less responsible. You're showing a hypnotized person less. You've got his face jammed up more. You've certainly got him at effect. And you're pushing him in. Now, this is quite interesting. Quite interesting to look over, processing, and recognize that it's based first and foremost on a postulate. The reversal of the postulate, you see, the person's got the postulate, is the total effect of the postulate, and isn't familiar with it. Doesn't even know he's got this postulate, you see. So you just increase his familiarity with it, which you can do in a lecture. And sometimes a person listening to a lecture all of a sudden gets a tremendous cognition, you know, bing, you know, wow, you know, bang. Well, he's just been submerged below a recognition of something, you see. And he comes suddenly into a recognition of the thing. Well, he's already started on his line. Now, the next thing is the individual in his ability to confront the isness of something, you might say, or conceive the isness of something, gets more and more at cause point over it, and so his responsibility picks up, and he eventually comes up into responsibility for creation of it. Now, that doesn't matter whether it's a wall, or a thought, or an idea. It doesn't matter what it is, but he recognizes creation of it, and this is quite normally covered by a very sloppy word, cognition. Cognitions come out of the bank, they're manufactured by the individual, and so on. But what they mean basically is an increased understanding. And it's no longer a sloppy word if you understand that a cognition merely means he voices an increased understanding of something. Mm-hmm. You want to beware one of these PCs that never says, well, what do you know? You know, he's sitting there being processed and or walking around being processed, and he says, well, he says, say, what do you know, for a long time, so on, so on, so on. Beware of a PC who doesn't do that. He's not getting any place. In other words, the understanding factor isn't coming up, so his communication factor isn't changing. Communication factor depends basically upon willingness to confront the isness of. And that's what communication depends on. A person can communicate with things that he's willing to confront and they omit the isness of. And the less he is willing to confront it, the less he's willing to admit the isness of it, the more out of communication it is, and you get this thing known as reality. That is the exact manufacturing point of the factor we call reality. Now, responsibility comes about for willingness to have a number of attitudes toward the isness. That may be it's a little bit strange to you, but it's just willingness to have created it, willingness to destroy it, willingness to go on having it be there, willingness to create another one like it, a willingness to move it around, willingness to give it away, willingness to receive it. You see, these all fall into this package word responsibility. Total responsibility would include perhaps innumerable attitudes, all of which a person would be willing to have. Now, willingness is one of your basic keynotes. If a person believes that a wall isn't, while he is standing there facing it, you could say he has a low reality on it, right? You could also say he's unwilling to communicate with it, right? Now, the communication with the wall is the approach of the auditor, or the communication with the thought or the postulate, which is ablative. Communication is the common denominator of all processes. People will self-audit. They self-audit on the simple mechanism of setting up a circuit to audit them, or they are auditing a circuit, because it's a two-universe. You see, it's a two-universe because you're going to have communication in the universe. Then there's got to be communication from and to. So if there's going to be any communication in the universe, or any reality, or therefore any universe at all, you've got to have a from and to. So naturally, you have a two-pole universe. Everything falls under two poles. Now, when an individual has been more and more removed from this universe and considered himself more and more an isolated single pole, things, of course, are less and less real, and he has approached more and more of an impossibility. Until he's gotten to a point where, what wall, what anything, you see? Now, individuation is another factor in processing, and individuation means different than, conceiving differences. Now, to communicate, you have to conceive some slight difference. But as you obsessively walk away from something and have to communicate it while being unwilling to communicate with it, you more and more grip onto this thing called individuation. You are more and more one, in other words. You are different than. You get the idea? You're different than it. And it says, well, you're the same as me. And you maybe insist then, and you say, no, I'm different than you. No, my name is Joe, and your name is Bill. The reason husbands and wives get along well, when they get along well, usually depends upon their ability to recognize and take responsibility for the differences on the communication line. There are differences on the communication line. A woman's a woman, a man is a man. And when they get along badly, they're not willing to take responsibility for the differences on the communication line, but are trying desperately to differentiate between themselves and be more and more each one himself or herself. So, look, a woman begins to doubt she's a woman and then has to insist that she is a woman. The man, because of the environment and ideas and so forth, begins to believe that he's less a man and begins to insist that he's more of a man. For instance, some college kid, some little child having to puff on a big bulldog pipe, you know, puff on a big pipe, you know, and drink up everything he can get his hands on, you know, to be a man. I can tell you, any kid that has to do that never got a pat on the back from his pop, that's all. All he needed was a little assurance once in a while. Yes, son, you're a boy. You know? That's all it took. And a little girl that's subjected all the time to, oh, I wish you'd been a boy. If you'd just been a boy, well, it'd have been so much better, and so forth. And, you know, I always wanted a boy, one of the parents is saying, and so on. See, after a while, it gets rocky. See? She has to assert the individuation, which shouldn't have to be asserted at all, but is actually quite apparent, becomes less and less apparent to her, and she becomes more and more different. We don't care what she becomes different than. She certainly becomes different. She obsessively becomes different. She's got to be an individual. She's got to be herself, you see? And she moves right on out, and the individuation gets so sharp after a while that the person is no longer capable of any communication. They've moved right on out of the firmament, you might say. Now, the way out is the way through. This is an old maxim of processing. The way out is the way through. More about that later. But the individual has actually got to come back into communication before, on their own determinism, they can go out of communication. Individuation is that action of asserting that other things are other determined, or that all other things are other determinism. Individual is saying, well, my wife is other determinism. The man is saying, wife is other determinism. The woman is saying, well, my husband is other determinism. Now we've got more and more other determinism entering in, and we have the dwindling spiral. The dwindling spiral is based on this got to be a separate thing, which finally becomes I got to be just a one thing, you see. And as soon as an individual is totally a one thing, he begins to go out of communication with the isness of it all, because he conceives the great differentness and the total difference and his irresponsibility for the environment around him. Actually, the reason the universe is visible is because of this exact mechanism I've just been describing. The reason it's visible and goes on and on and on and on and on is more or less based on this obsessive individuation of the individual. They invent gods. If man didn't have a god in any given period, he'd invent one, because he's got to have somebody to assign their responsibility for as one of the handy mechanisms of preventing things from being as is. Cross up the ownership, you see, and so forth. And so he won't take the total responsibility for the thing and so on. He dreams this up. But this gets to be too bad of a thing after a while, and an individual can no longer survive. He can no longer survive because he can't survive alone. That's the blunt part of it. If he's going to be part of this universe and live in this universe, he's certainly going to live with others. That's for true. And the less he understands this, why, the more difficulties he gets into. Finally becomes the total effect of the whole universe. Now, you find this individual, and of course he's backed away from so many communication lines, he's taken so little responsibility for anything, that it's necessary for us to get him familiar with thoughts, terminals, and gradually walk him back into a point where he is causative over these on his own determinism, rather than some automatic, obsessive, got to be cause, got to be different, you know. Move it up so he takes over the automaticity of causation, increases familiarity, and the whole thing boils down to the fact that you actually pilot him into greater familiarity and greater communication, with the net result that you wind up with a greater reality. When you do this, you have somebody who can confront, and who is, oddly enough, and I suppose quite by accident, but very true, he is more social, he is more capable, he is a better asset of the society. He's somebody to know, he's somebody to talk to. Before then, he was just a ball of flesh rolling about, out of contact with everything. Now, they're the exact end goals of processing. A process never does by itself anything. It has to be applied to a PC, it has to be directed, and it has to have an end goal and result. And when a process is handled by the auditor and is used by the auditor and it's intelligently applied by an auditor, you get tremendous gains that you will never contact on such a thing as just wound up doll, repeat it, repeat it, repeat it, and hope something happened. Thank you. Thank you.